When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the Joshua Morales Podcast.
All right, so we are on the podcast and we are live with Ruben. So Ruben, give us a little bit of a background and how did you get into what you're doing now?
Well, let me say that I'm a former elected official. I did that for 14 years. I was a mayor pro tem, city commissioner, EDC president with director duties. More importantly, Josh, I want to say that I was a small business person, still am. Been doing that for about 30 years, and I take a lot of passion in saying that I've been a volunteer for about the same amount of time, 30 years. So I spilled over into the, if you want to talk the social media realm, if you will, where you expose your life and you're vulnerable to all ends, probably around 2008 through my wife, who encouraged me to get on Facebook at the time. And of course I resisted because, oh my God, no, I can't be on Facebook. Everybody will know what I'm doing. And she encouraged me to do that, but I used it as a platform, like it's used now, to road closures, water breaks, emergencies, all kinds of situations that information needed to get out fast. I used Facebook back in 2008, right. And it was extremely effective. People warmed up to it, although it did give me some criticism from a small conservative town. Overall, it was very, very useful.
So you were talking about this off air, and you were talking about being hesitant about going on to social media. Why were you hesitant about it?
Well, when you're growing up, for the most part, in my age group, I'm 56 years old, anybody probably 38, 40 plus, you're taught to be humble, to be more thoughtful of people rather than yourself. This thing about taking selfies and talking about your actions and capturing your life was not something that was easy or was common in my growing up, my formative years. My father taught me how to work hard and how to give back to your community, but it definitely didn't include the facets of sharing your life in intimate and not so intimate moments, because let's face it, anything you share on social media, if it's your life, it's gonna be intimate, whether it be a birthday or whether it be a special celebration or a heartache, because people share all sorts of things on social media. So, getting into this wasn't the easiest of things. I had to retrain my brain, but I want to give credit to my wife. She is my coach. She's the instant professor, but she teaches me, she gives me insight, and we evaluate each other. And without that, I don't think I would have been able to, come as far as I have.
And how long ago was that you started?
2008, I want to say very, very early 2008 when I got into Facebook. I got on Twitter probably about 2011, and I got into Instagram probably about 2011, 2012. I want to say that each platform is different, but of all the platforms, the one that's opened the most door for me has been Twitter, without a doubt. I mean, Josh, I've done interviews with the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, with the BBC across the pond. I've done stuff with, on New York. I was on Border Live, and they found me on a Google search and on my social media. And the first time I communicated with them was a direct message on Twitter. And that's not so uncommon. When I tell people, they tend to make like a surprise face, but that's the world we live in now.
Yeah.
Nobody calls anybody. Nobody's gonna send me an email, much less open an email. But if you get a direct message like you and I did, you're going to answer it, because it's the real world now.
That's true. So you're saying that Twitter's your strongest platform that you're using right now?
It's the one that's opened the most doors for me. I want to say that my strongest platform, without a doubt, right now is Instagram. People will get a real look of many facets of my life. I am 56 years old. I have sons. I have a great wife, a great life. I have adventure like this right here. I mean, who else you know, gets an opportunity to come with yourself, who you're pretty accomplished in the social media world in the Rio Grande Valley, and get to talk about, you know, what has made them the person they are in social media and in life. It's actually considered a blessing to be able to do that. But that it's easy, absolutely not. We talked off air how challenging it is for young people and especially for old people. And since I deal a lot with what I call late adapters, people that are older, in their 40s, who are in small business or trying to brand themselves, trying to spread their message, because let's face it, Josh, newspapers, magazines, billboards, that type of marketing is suffering because social media has all the eyeballs. I mean, you know, I think, what is it, Facebook and YouTube, I think each have like 1.5 billion users.
That's crazy. The number is insane.
It's a crazy amount of people, yeah.
So right now, how are you leveraging Instagram stories to talk to your potential clients or potential audience?
What I do on Instagram and on Facebook, for that matter, I'm a video creator. I'm a self-taught video editor. I learned the hard way through trial, error, and YouTube. And it was hard. It was very hard. I tell people all the time, it's a skill now that I appreciate. And I call it going down the rabbit hole, because it encompasses your entire main lines of thinking. I'm not left with very much creative and energy after editing, but I'm leveraging it to let people know that, you know, you can be 50 or 40 or 60 or 70 and still get in the game and do it effectively if you have passion for it. I'm a big proponent of using the many tools that your smartphone offers. You don't have to go buy, if you want to do video, you don't have to go buy a $1,000 camera or a $2,000 camera. You can do it with your iPhone. And what I do typically is I teach people how to do it. You look at my IGTV and you'll see I give people lessons. My one of the more popular videos that I did that got a lot of response was the 3 C's for Instagram and social media.
That's right, I saw that. Can you touch on that?
Well, it got a lot of good traction, a lot of good feedback. And keep in mind, the feedback I get, Josh, is not a like on the video itself or even a DM. It's when they see me.
Yeah.
Hey, I saw that video you did about talking about confidence. And I saw that video you did. The 3 C's, real simple, and my wife really likes my philosophy. I like to break things down. I come from government and I come from business. And even every time that I was there, I was all about a method and a template to do something, a protocol. So I thought of a way to get people started, and came from a real story. I was at a fundraising event, and this gentleman, who's a very good, accomplished chef, he's an outdoor chef, he barbecue-wise, and he came to me and says, Ruben, I have a problem. I want to spill over into Instagram and social media, Facebook, and I don't know how to do it. I have accounts, but I don't know how to do it. So I got to thinking, and I came up with the 3 C's for Instagram and social media. And the first C is confidence. You have to be confident in your message, and you have to present it that way. If you want to be taken seriously in what you do, be confident. Don't talk like, well, I'm not sure, I don't know, maybe this. No, hey, this is the way I cook. This is my dry rub. In video creation, hey, I use iMovie, but you know what? I'm very careful with my edits to make sure I tell the right story. Confidence. The second one is content. I'm a big believer in content having variety. If you're in business, the temptation is, Josh, to put ad after ad after
right.
ad. If you're selling cars, you're going to put a lot of cars. If you sell real estate, house after house. If you sell furniture, you're going to put pictures of the furniture. People don't want that.
Right.
When you buy a magazine, people still buy magazines. Sports Illustrated doesn't just have pictures of sports. It has pictures of travel. It has pictures of apparel. It has pictures of sport. It has a variety of information. Also, where your content is concerned, it has to be wholesome and genuine. Be real. Don't give them some phony shim-sham of an appearance, because when they meet you, it's going to be a disappointment. And when that happens, it will translate into your social media presence. And the best thing you can do for yourself is be yourself.
Right.
Because that's all you know how to do. And the last one's my favorite. I call it the great equalizer. And that one is consistency. Let me repeat that. The great equalizer is consistency. If you're lacking in your content ability, if you're lacking in your confidence, if you're consistent, if you're just out there hammering away, beating that drum, somebody's going to hear you. And the thing that consistency allows you, it gives your content a chance to get better, and it gives your confidence a chance to grow and get stronger.
Right. No, I completely agree. So we were actually talking about how a lot of people won't like or engage with certain content, but when you're out is when they tell you something.
Yeah.
I think also that happens to me quite a bit, because I post out so much stuff and they're like, oh, I did see that, but they won't necessarily like it or engage with that. Can you touch on that, how that's happened in your area?
It's a mindset, especially and you're younger than I am, you're in your 30s and I'm in my 40s, but you get anybody again who's 30, late 30s on plus, they're not gonna like pictures, they're not gonna like your video, they're not gonna comment, but they'll look at it, even if they look at it silently, but they're gonna look at it and they know that, they'll know your content. I have had so many incidences, like my 3Cs, where, I mean, I got okay views, you know, whatever shows there, but I've had people that already stopped me and said, hey, I saw that video, and you're right, I gotta work on my confidence. I've been doing this for 15 years, I should be more confident with my message. It's crazy how much people will look at but not acknowledge or give you that acknowledgement on social media. Now, for example, you get one of these millennials that'll post a picture of a beach umbrella and they get 479 likes, and yours says it's a beach umbrella, you know. But that's the world that they did grow up with a smartphone in their hand, and they did grow up understanding, you know, these visuals, and it's okay to interact, and you're not exposing yourself if you hit the like button.
Right.
It's not. But teaching anybody that later in life is very difficult. So I don't even encourage people. I said, if it's not in your being to go out there and like and encourage and comment, then don't do it whenever it's comfortable. But most certainly, understand one thing. I think you and I can appreciate this. If we put something out there, whether it be a video or whether it be a piece of content, whatever traction you think you're getting, multiplied by 10 times, and that's probably the type of attention that either video or content is getting. Eyeballs are looking at it. It's just not the kind of eyeballs that are clicking on like buttons.
Yeah, exactly. So going back to the social media world, right? I asked this to a couple of people before. Do you think that it's a good thing that the social media world has given a voice to everybody, regardless if it's right or if it's wrong?
Yes, I think it's good.
Go ahead and touch on that.
You know, it's we have a freedom of speech, and you can say a lot of things. It has limitations, obviously. You know, you have a freedom to say what you want to say, but you can't scream fire in a crowded theater. The reason that I think it's a good thing is because you don't know where the next brilliant idea is coming from. It could be from somebody you agree with, and it could be from somebody you don't agree with. I want to say I was in government, Josh, and I learned more from my detractors than I ever did sometimes from my supporters. Because if I built a park, for example, or I was part of a group that built a park, and they were like, oh, you should have added elements for disabilities. I was like, you're right, I should have, you know? But it came as a heavy criticism, but you got to take that criticism and turn it into something that's constructive. So I think what social media does, it does give everybody a platform. But keep in mind, you can give everybody a platform, not everybody's using it.
True.
And the ones that use it and may sometimes make the most noise are the ones that are trying to spread the message with more gusto. But the idea that everybody can get on something like this and start creating an idea and giving life to whatever lives in their mind is a very good thing. And after all, if you don't like that content, block and delete them.
Yeah.
I encourage people. I mean, people my age, you know, like I say, I keep on saying my age. I'm 56 years old. But people that are older, they're like, well, you know, this guy was criticizing me and he used profanity. And well, block them, delete them. If you want to be nice, you can send them a message saying, please don't. That's one thing that I don't accept on any of my pages, profanity. Talk to me in good, solid, basic, respectful terms, and I'll always respond.
Right.
Even if it's criticism, but don't swear to me. That's just not the way that anybody should conduct themselves. And I think that's my upbringing, and also how I conducted myself as an elected official. I would allow any kind of criticism, but I would not allow profanity.
Right.
So that was my no-fly zone. So the fact that everybody has the ability to go out there and create their wondrous dream of a message, you know, power to you. Get out there and do it and see who listens. And if you don't like it, you know what? Tune them out.
Yeah. No, I feel like we can talk social media literally all day long.
Oh, sure.
Because, you know, that's what we dive ourselves into.
And you know what? Let me tell you what. The dichotomy of who you and I are. You're 37. I'm 20 years older than you are. Yet, I think we're pretty much level because you try certain things. I try certain things. You know, we both are into capturing images. We both into spreading a certain message about whatever we're passionate about. And you're right. We can. But that's how social media or Instagram or Twitter or whatever you care to, it can bridge these huge gaps, because all of a sudden you're not 37, I'm not 56. We're at the same plateau trying to do the same thing because we're passionate about what we do.
Yeah. Have you ever gotten a backlash from certain things that you put online?
Of course.
What was the worst one that you
ever got? Oh, the worst backlash. I think one time I made a snide remark about these decorations, this ear piercing that young people do where they make holes in their ear.
Yeah.
And I made a reference saying that, you know, my father would have probably said, you know, just cut the whole ear off if you're not going to use it the right way. And I made a reference like that, and I think I did have somebody stop me in Walmart because they were, I think they were more edgy on that side and saying that I was being disrespectful to people that have other ideas. And I agree with her. I said, you're right, I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
I'm always, if I, you know, I said it in a joke sort of way, but sometimes humor does offend people, and she was offended, so I apologize. I'm sorry, you're right. I don't have that chip where I'm like, oh, I'm right. I made a poor joke, and you know what? The one thing about something that you do that's a misstep, it gets fixed up an awful lot and really quick when you say, I'm sorry, I'll never do it again. I didn't. So yeah. Now if anybody wants to like make holes in their ears or holes in their head, you know, go right ahead.
Yeah, sometimes I find that strange because we do have the freedom of speech. We can post whatever we want, but also social media makes us aware of how we speak, of how we talk, and right, to be politically correct most of the time, right? Because the last thing I do is I rarely ever get into politics, and I just feel like if you're in politics, it's just an easy target for you to go after and for everybody to come after you.
I got attacked many, many times when I was an elected official, many times.
How do you deal with that?
Respectfully, calmly, and with logic and information and common sense.
Yeah.
Let me repeat that, common sense. That's so lacking in government, is just the basic understanding of what works. Let's get away from the philosophy of it has to be this way or it has to be that way. Everybody has an opinion, but I use my common sense to guide me and to show me a path that I feel is productive and pragmatic in the world. And you're right, I did spend a lot of time being politically correct when I was mayor. It took me a long time to get away from that, where I can be more expressive about my beliefs. Because when I was mayor, Josh, I had a belief in Uruguay City, the population is about 16,000, give or take. And I believe that my voice was resonating for 16,000 people. So I was trying my best to make sure that I would ride that line very carefully, that I was trying to represent as big a cut of those 16,000 people. Now, fast forward to the year 2019, that's not so common in some circles of government, where you hear different types of conversation at different levels, especially the federal level. I'm not going to get into that, but as far as I'm concerned, you know, if you represent more than yourself when you're elected official, which you do, you need to be respectful of the entire population, not just what you believe to be correct or to be right.
No, I completely agree. So you were the mayor of Rio Grande City, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So the next topic that we're going to jump into is border crisis.
Yeah.
You were in New York earlier, right?
I was in New York November of 2018, and I was there through the end of December, yeah.
All right, so you're not a dummy when you talk about these things. You actually know what you're talking about.
I consider myself a border expert, and I will tell you that. I don't mind saying that at this point. Growing up in a small town, right next to the river, Josh, I mean, right here where we are, McAllen's a good 4 or 5 miles, 6 miles, whatever it is. I mean, I grew up 3 minute walking distance from the river, and I just thought that's the way everybody lived.
Yeah.
I don't know any better. So all these immigration challenges and all these scenarios, I've lived them. Everything from human traffickers, drug traffickers, coyotes, immigrants coming out of the woodwork to come and ask for everything from a few bucks to a glass of water. I mean, I lived it from a very early age. So when people talk about immigration, I feel very confident that I know exactly what I'm talking about, because I lived it.
Yeah.
Not knowing. Now I'll tell you, the one who brought it to light was my wife, because she moved to Virgin City with me for a while, and she was saying, you know what's going on here is not normal. And I'm like, well, yeah, it's normal. She said, no, it's not. She's from McAllen. She said, I can tell you people in McAllen don't know anything what's going on and don't have a firsthand ability to have knowledge of this like you do. Because, you know, immigrants from Central America, from Mexico, from China, whatever. Yes, I experienced some of that at some capacity, you know, during my time living in Rio Grande. I live in Mission now. But for 53 of my 56 years, I lived in a small town, a border town, whose river was a part of our DNA and still is. I tell people, when you grow up next to a river, the river runs through you and never leaves you.
Yeah.
I speak fluent English, Spanish, and border. Yeah. And I say that proudly now.
It's interesting because this past weekend, me and my wife went to Mexico because we're returning our permisos. We're about to go out of town, and they were expired. But on the way back, we actually saw the bus that brings back the people that were deported back into Mexico, and they're all in their handcuffs, and they're also their legs were handcuffed too. It's a pretty startling thing to see. It's just literally right there. We're just in line, and then they drop them off, and then
Yeah. They
go about their. Is that a common occurrence?
Yeah.
Because so I'm like, yeah. I said, I'm not really from this world, so I kind of need somebody like you to educate me about these things.
It has become more visible, but that process, they were probably Mexican residents. The first, I had a two-part education in immigration. The first part, for the most of my life, was that the immigrants were going to be from Mexico. They were all between the ages of 16 to maybe as much as 50. And I want to say almost exclusively we're coming here for work.
Okay.
That was a good chunk of my life till about 20, probably about 2012 when I saw a little bit of a shift. But that's what they were. They were young, strapping, hardworking, strong men looking for a job, looking for employment, looking for economic opportunity. You know, Mexico is paying $35, you know, a week, and here you can get $9 an hour. So, I mean, it's real simple. And that whole facet of my experience was one, and it did shift. It absolutely shifted in the year 2014. I was ground zero for the first wave of Central Americans that came into the United States through pretty much the same means you're seeing now. And yes, there were women, and yes, there were children. I'll never forget, I went to a guy named Gil Kolakowski, I'll massacre his name, but he was just coming in the Obama administration. They invited everybody to go to the McAllen Border Patrol Station, the famous one now that everybody tours.
Yeah.
And he came in and he was just talking about immigration. And I went because I believed in regional representation. So when I was invited, I would go to anything that was regional, that was beyond the realm of my small town. And when they were done, they said, hey, you want to take a tour of the facility? And I was like, yeah. There was four of us, and there was a room of about 30, and four took the tour. And this was March of 2014. And when we go, and if you've never been in there, they have like windows, you know, they're tempered glass windows, but they're windows where you can see in the cells. And I looked inside and I saw women and children, and I was floored. I got the Border Patrol agent and said, hey, what are women and children doing in there? And he said, Mayor, that's what we're seeing now.
Wow.
So my eyes got this big, and of course I went back to Rio Grande City talking about that. And next thing I know, of course, I had friends who were in Border Patrol, and they were like, oh yeah, we're seeing that now. I want to say that was in March. By about April, the first immigration crisis of 2014, the one that I saw firsthand, I saw unfold before my eyes.
Wow.
They were Central American. They were from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. And you could tell, Josh, because they were different. Their mannerisms were different. They were more brash. They were less respectful of the mores and the common habits of the Mexican immigrant. The Mexican immigrant would hide. These wouldn't hide. They were looking to give themselves up.
Interesting.
And they would hide under cars. They would go into HEBs. That was a big problem because they were going into private property. So my phone was ringing constantly because they had my number and they were going to call the mayor and say, hey, get a grip on this. I just saw one almost get run over by a car because they're running across busy streets.
Wow.
Their understanding of the border was non-existent. So I just want to say it was kind of very much the Wild West, the first wave. And I will tell you that when I worked with National Guard, DPS, Ranger Recon, the DPS, obviously, Border Patrol, Customs. I worked with all those facets of those law enforcement agencies because my town needed that help. Josh, I had three patrol officers covering 10 square miles. And if I told you that those three officers spent during that time of about April of 2014 to about September of 2014, they would spend hours upon hours under a tree babysitting immigrants.
Really?
Waiting for Border Patrol was overwhelmed. They only had so many Border Patrol agents So they would make a call and say, we'll be there in 45 minutes. We're in Fronton, which is way west Stark County. So I would stop with my officers and I'd say, what are y'all doing? Well, we can't leave them alone, so we're going to have to wait for Border Patrol, and they're about an hour away.
Wow.
And that was nerve-wracking for me, because who's patrolling the streets? Who's patrolling the shopping centers? Who's patrolling the school zones?
Exactly.
I only had three officers. So when DPS showed up and National Guard showed up and all these, we embraced them, because they helped us do our job, because we didn't have to take care of the immigrants. We still did, but we were allowed to do what our public safety requirements were, which is keep our community safe.
Yeah.
So when you see this crisis of today, Josh, and here's, you're going to see me criticize government, they maybe couldn't predict it, but they should have had the ability to foresee it, undoubtedly. Because everything's happening now, I saw in 2014.
Really?
The women, the children, yeah, the family units, the confusion on how to handle them. Where are you going to house them? How are you going to house them?
Is that just because this is the sheer number of people that are coming in?
What happens is that the coyotes are very savvy. They look for loopholes in immigration because it's good for their business. I promise you, they're making five times as much money on human trafficking as they are in drug trafficking right now. Because every person that you see, all those people, they came through corridors that are controlled by the coyotes and controlled by the cartels. And I guarantee you, they paid anything between $2,000 and up to $10,000 per person.
Wow.
And I understand that children now are coming at a higher premium, especially if they're unaccompanied, because they're high management, high risk, and they're a lot of trouble.
Wow.
So if I told you that and you see these raw numbers, just do the math. These are millions and millions and millions of dollars that these cartels are cashing in on, because they do control the border region on the Mexican, absolutely without a doubt.
Yeah.
The corridors that matter, they control.
Why do you think there's more women and children now trying to get into the United States?
Well, because that's a free ticket to the yellow submarine, you know? That gets you on board. You know, what they found was a loophole that if you were had children with you, you were allowed to stay. And you're automatically put in a process to be taken out of here. So what the reason you're seeing women and children is because that is a loophole. How do you handle them? Nobody knows it. And the problem is that the federal government hasn't been proactive enough or even reactive enough to come up with legislation to deal with this. This is squarely on their clock. And I'm talking Democrats and Republicans, because those are the ones that make the laws. The laws are not working. So if you see women and children coming across the border, it's because they know that they're going to get preferred treatment and be allowed to stay here.
Wow.
Which they are. They're not being sent back. They're the ones that if you come with a family unit, you're allowed to stay here for 2 to 3 years until your trial date, where you go before a judge. And that's enough. The whole system is lacking and it needs to be rebooted. And when people tell me that immigration cannot be fixed, you know, Josh, I'm older than you. I'm a big fan of the Ronald Reagan days, because he was my president when I was a teenager and into my 20s. And I want to tell you that in 1988 or thereabouts, he passed comprehensive immigration reform for 3 million undocumented that were here. And he did it with a Democratic congressman and a Democratic Congress under the leadership of Thomas Tip O'Neill. So when people say that immigration cannot be fixed, I disagree completely, because it's been done. It was done 30 years ago. And when he did it back then, he did it as a starting point to keep on fixing it. But the wheels fell off and everybody forgot. So immigration can be fixed, should be fixed, needs to be fixed. And you know something, the template that's necessary is there. People know what it is. The lawmakers know. But for whatever reason, they're not wanting to come to the table to find out the solutions that need to be set forth.
So for people like me that aren't too aware of, like you were just talking about, the perfect example of how to fix immigration, what is that? How would you explain that to somebody like me, that 1980?
Well, you mean fix immigration?
Yeah.
Well, let's come up with reality. There's about 11 million undocumented that live here. Well, that's before this last wave, so I don't know what it is, but it was 11 million. The simple fact of the matter is, Josh, the FBI can't find the 10 top most wanted people, and they're not going to find 11 million undocumented immigrants. So that's the first realization. They're here already. The second thing that you also come to grips with is that they came in through a broken system that the United States provided to them. It's not like they came in, you know, under the circumstances of knowing that the government here had a very tight immigration policy that was very hard to maneuver. They came because it was ambiguous.
Right.
And they were looking to capitalize. So going back, the first thing you realistically do is come up with a way to identify these 11 million like they did back in 1988, 1987. And I want to say it the way it sounds. If they've been here for an X amount of time, say 5 years, 6 years, you know, you're going to see the reality of bringing them into the system because they're here already.
Right.
They're contributing, you know, whether we want to admit it or not. So the first thing is those 11 million that are out there, you know, bring them into our system with certain conditions. And a condition that people forget is, like, they broke the law, yes, but make them pay a fine, make them go through the process. Now people say, oh, you know, they're gonna come and vote, and you know what? Let them apply for voting rights whenever they feel it's necessary. You know, you can't even get American citizens to vote.
Right.
So when people just think it's an issue about trying to bring in a voting bloc, I disagree, because you can't even get people that are registered to vote already to come out and vote. But a part of the fix is, and I'll say it the way it sounds, you know, people say build a wall where it's necessary. Like when people have told me before, when I did interviews before, say, well, do we need the wall? And I would say, where? And it would send them back, well, along the border. Well, where along the border? Well, in the valley. Well, where along the valley?
Right.
And I wasn't being cute. I was being realistic that the valley has about 260 miles of border region, of border area, and it's about 125 miles straight across. But keep in mind that the river winds. It winds, you know, like a snake. It goes up and down in all sorts of ways. So when people are telling me build a wall, they first tell me where. If it's an area that typically has a river area, a river basin that's very shallow where you can walk across, okay, yeah, cool.
Yeah, it makes sense.
But if it's an area that's right next to a community that the river is anywhere between 12 to 16 feet deep with strong currents, what more wall do you want?
Right.
Because that river is a great reason to not try it, and you'll look for those pockets. So again, put a wall, if you will, or a fence. It's really a fence, not a wall. Put a fence where it's necessary, but more importantly, bring in the high technology that we have already available to us that just hit our doorsteps just years ago. Like, I don't know if you travel west, but you travel west, you see something called TARS, Tethered Aerostat Radar Systems. Have you seen them, little blimps? Have you seen them?
Mm, oh, yeah. Yes, I have.
Okay, they're called TARS. Now, the irony of those is, first of all, they were recycled pieces of equipment from the Iraqi Afghan conflicts.
Interesting.
Now, they didn't just bring them off shelf. Here they are.
Yeah.
They're recycled from the war, the first thing. And the second thing is, the first one, I went to that ceremony. It was in Roma, Texas in 2014, the summer 2014, when they brought the first TARS to the valley. And you go, oh, wow, so great. You research on those instruments of detection. They've been around for 40 years.
Hmm. So why? And it's surveillance, right?
Oh, yeah. They go up in the air, and then they have high coverage surveillance where they can see. I mean, I've seen what they allow me to see. You're basically looking at like a video game where you see people moving through the woods. You can see it all.
Wow. So yeah. Like infrared cameras.
Everything,
and stuff like that.
Everything's there. But the problem is that technology only came in 2014. Why didn't we have it before?
Yeah.
And you know, we don't have cameras along the border. People think we have cameras. We don't have cameras along the border. I saw the process of them trying to give me the cameras as a city, so we can maintain the cameras. And I'm like, you know, don't give me the cameras. That's your responsibility.
Yeah.
So the basic technology that. High technology that needs to be there is not there. So if we put a combination of, again, a wall fixture where we need it, if we bring in high technology surveillance equipment where it's necessary, because it is, and you bring boots on the ground in big numbers, I promise you that our immigration situation would be under control. However, here's the however. Nowadays, you're dealing with a wild card, which is how do you handle family units? That's where legislation comes in.
Interesting. All right, give me 1 second. Jesse is downstairs, so I'm going to bring him up.
Okay.
And then we'll continue. I got a couple more questions.
I'm in the middle of a podcast, but Josh had to go downstairs, but this is what the podcast room looks like. Actually, it's pretty cool setup. I am in the middle of a podcast with Josh, and he was sitting back there. He went downstairs, but I figured I'd take the opportunity, this break we had, to show you his kind of cool setup here.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Okay.
Room, I'm gonna move this right here. You know this guy, right?
Just throw it, man. Just put it out there.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up?
You're good.
Take a nap. Grab a seat.
Close the door.
Yeah, please. All right.
Well, I guess I might as well do a. Hey, Josh, hello.
Hello. How's it going?
Hey, what's going on?
I'm in good company. You see. I'm in good company.
Alrighty. Let me know when you're ready, Ruben.
Give me a second, let me do this real quick.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. It's Mike's place, Mike Palesas.
Oh, really?
You know? Or no? No?
Heard his name.
Jesse, what are you on Instagram?
Jesse.
Have you? What kind of stuff on your
name? Should be Jerry.
There you go.
Yeah. Mike, what does he do?
He has an online radio. He has like 3 or 4 different shows.
Okay.
So I also think, I'm not sure what else he does, but he started this, the podcast room, and I just jumped on it. I was like, yeah, let's try it.
Wow.
So, all right, you ready to do this?
Yeah.
All right, so here we go. So we were talking about the border, right? Border crisis. But I kind of want to go into what digital media is nowadays. So Google, Apple, Facebook, they have so much data on everybody. It's kind of scary, right? But I heard that data is a new oil. So it's overtaking oil. Like it's the number one asset now that anybody can own. How do you feel about these huge platforms having so much data on us?
Yeah, it is scary, I will tell you, and it's something that I don't think anybody's, well, again, about ages, is used to. It's something that we're gonna have to adjust. A long time ago, somebody said something about Big Brother watching. Big Brother has never had a bigger set of eyes than today. And in spite of the fact that you have all this technology and all this data, so many small things, you know, don't get detected. I can go on and talk about examples of people putting stuff online that might be a danger to our communities and not being detected. It's crazy. But the fact that we're so out there and living off the grid per se has become ultimately so difficult. It's just the world that we live in now, Josh. It is. You know, once upon a time, radio was high technology, and then it got replaced by television. And then television went by the wayside now with social media and Lord knows what's next. Roll with the punches. And yeah. Here's what I tell my clients when they talk about social media and their fears of privacy is show as much as you want, but don't show you have complete control over the amount of information or what information you're going to share.
Right.
So share what you feel comfortable sharing. Share enough to be a little bit vulnerable, but you don't have to share everything.
Yeah, you can craft your story to the way you want it to be shown to people.
Well, you can craft it, and the only danger with that, not danger, the only thing that I tell people be careful with, don't make it seem overly glamorous, and don't make it seem overly not like you. You know, stay genuine to what your message is and to who you are. And you'll find success on social media on many platforms, but you have to give them that experience. If they see you on social media and they know who you are and they meet you in person, if it's the same person that they see, then you did it right.
Right. So we're talking about data. And I ran across a Facebook post the other day where somebody was typing, it was like I think it was the 9 most wanted list. And somebody said, let's get on that list. With the mass shootings that are going on now, that sucks, right? The world social media has given us is very vulgar, it's very open to everybody. But when you have people like this, what do you think should be in place as far as like monitoring these people or as far as like reporting these people? I think that's super important.
Well, you touched on something. It's let's go to the most recent issue we had in the mass shooting we had in El Paso. Let me just send a great prayers to our fellow border community in El Paso. I have friends over there. It's horrific. As you know, as sophisticated as we get and our abilities to monitor data, if you will, seem to be impressive, we miss the mark when we should be capturing data that's, again, dangerous to our community. This gentleman, whatever his name is, I won't even mention his name, but he did go and he posted a manifesto online. And you would think, well, you know, well, he posted it, that's not enough reaction time. Well, it's not. Well, you know what? All I can tell you is go post a copyrighted song on Facebook and see how long it takes for them to drop your video.
Oh, yeah.
It'll be less than a minute and a half maybe. So if Facebook can have that ability, I don't see why the federal government can't have that ability also to detect an emergency quickly and to have law enforcement officers in the right places to protect the community. Because as much as we feel that social media is a great big wild world, but it's also a world that needs to be monitored, and the federal government needs to do a better job of watching the dangers that could come to us via social media.
So what do you think about like Mark Zuckerberg, right? It's a private, well, kind of private company. He wants everything to stay on Facebook. He wants to control it. He doesn't want any federal government in there. How do you feel there should be, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, do you think that Mark Zuckerberg should let the federal government come in and use that data for these type of things? Or do you think the private company should have access and keep all this stuff?
Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, and not just Facebook, but it's a matter of time before federal government takes over. It's inevitable. You see all that data, you see all the streaming of information, and I'm surprised the federal government hasn't made an initiative yet to try to get into that game and to basically take over Facebook. I think that Facebook and social media has turned into something larger than even Mark Zuckerberg ever imagined.
Right.
I think it's something that has grown to the point now where the federal government is going to want to take over, because they're going to say, well, we're better keepers of the data, which is questionable. I don't know if they're really efficient at anything. The federal government is not the best business person or the best monitor or the best resource to have when it comes to having a real good model for success. I tell people, if you want to ruin something, get the government involved. It's true.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I'm a big believer in small government and let business run itself and, you know, keep restrictions to a minimum. But the fact that all this data is there and Mark Zuckerberg has this huge, immense control, not just him, you have Bezos with I mean, there's
Amazon
yeah. even Elon Musk, and even he said it, that government is going to get involved. Because I think they feel a responsibility to do that. But one thing's for sure, Zuckerberg hasn't done a very good job of protecting the privacy of his information. We all know what's happened and how it happened, and how, you know, not talk conspiracies, but how foreign governments got involved in sensitive information to possibly sway opinion.
Yeah, the whole Cambridge Analytica scandal.
Yeah, it's real. It happened. So that's why I'm saying, you know, it's not like, you know, Zuckerberg's done an amazing job. He hasn't. I have very serious doubts that when the government takes over, that they'll do any better.
So we've been talking about a lot of stuff. I want to go back to your full-time job that you have now. It's digital marketing, social media. You're teaching a lot of people. You're always busy. And you and your wife are always busy. Is there such a thing as work-life balance? Because I can't find it.
Yes, there is such a thing. I haven't found it either. I want to tell you what, I work at 2 in the morning sometimes. It's sort of like, you know, I can schedule my day. But if you're going to be in this business in any capacity of success, if you're not putting 12, 14 hours, you know, a day for quite a few days, then you're not doing it right. Because one thing's for sure, you know, and I know, even to produce what you're doing right now, it's not just hit a few buttons, talk a few, say a few things, oh, it's cool, then put it on there.
Yeah.
There's a degree of preparation that goes to it before, during, and after. And in what I do now, I never imagined I would be in it the way I am. This whole thing of getting involved in this type of a business for somebody like myself, not because of my background, but because of my age. I mean, I run around sometimes with all these social media influencers and these people like yourself that do podcasts or that do video creation. I can name names, and they're all way younger than I am. I mean, way younger than I am. And they get a kick out of me sometimes because they see me. But one thing I will tell you, that you have to dedicate a lot of time if you're going to be in this business at this level.
Yeah, I find it fascinating that the internet has literally opened doors for everybody to do anything they've ever wanted. I find that fascinating.
It is, and in the same time, my wife's a big fan of Gary Vee,
mm-hmm.
and that's why now we've gone more into teaching and giving people, we'll give you the information, and Gary Vee always says you can give people all the information, 5% are going to use the information you give them. And in social media, it's a lot like that. Like, I tell people how to create video or how to do whatever platform they want to, that way they can maximize it, that way you don't have to go and hire somebody. But let's just face it, it's like doing the lawn. I tell people, it's like doing the lawn. I can do my lawn, but I'd rather hire somebody.
Yeah.
It's just a hassle, because social media, to be done correctly, is very, very time consuming.
Right.
It's not just, let me take a few pictures. No, you better get a white backdrop and get some lighting and get, you know, put them at the right angle. Because one thing's for sure, Josh, if you take all that time for all those little minute details, they do make a huge difference at the end. That's how I think you found your success, because I know you've been beating that drum, and so have I. And little by little, you know, things happen. But I tell people, it's a formula of years. It's not a formula of months.
Yeah.
If you invest years of time into social media, you're going to get dividends. If you're just willing to, you know, one of those recipes for add water and stir, that's not this.
Yeah, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint.
Well, it's funny thing is that people think it is. You know, it's like when you take on clients, I've taken on clients, and they're like, well, let's see how it looks in 3 months. And I just say, don't even hire us.
Yeah, it's not enough time.
3 months, people might, you know who, you know, a little bit of what you're trying to do. But the rule of thumb that I will tell you that we've come up with our clients and we've taught people, it's a year.
Yeah.
If you're out there a year consistently doing social media every day, if you're in business or branding, every day, and repeat that, every day. It's not I'm taking weekends off. So you don't take weekends off.
Yeah.
You do it every day. In a year's time, you're going to see very solid, good results.
Yeah, social media is 24/7, 365 days a year.
Yes, like it or not. But I will tell you what, for businesses that are trying to evolve and trying to find, you know, that niche that has been escaping them, it's an amazing, amazing tool. Like you say, you can still buy real estate on social media relatively inexpensively.
Yeah.
Go try to buy a billboard in a semi-busy part of town with good traffic and see how many thousands of dollars it costs you a month.
Easy. $3,000-$4,000.
Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah, and now on social media, if you come up with a product and you put some money behind it, you know, it's a couple hundred bucks.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot of money, but if you're going to get, you know, 15,000 eyeballs on it, that ain't bad.
Yeah, yeah. And it helps long-term keeping that relationship going online. I find it fascinating. So are you afraid of AI, artificial intelligence?
Very.
Why?
Let me put it this way. Human intelligence is pretty crazy already, and we've struggled to handle our own intelligence or lack thereof, and now we're creating artificial intelligence that might work on pure logic. And sometimes pure logic doesn't have emotion, doesn't have feeling, it doesn't have soul.
Yeah.
And I don't like anything that doesn't have a soul. Because at the end of the day, either you're fearful of God, or you're fearful of your parents, or you're fearful of authority, or you're fearful of your own fears. I don't think that artificial intelligence has a fear of anything. And I don't trust something that has no fear. You got to be fearful. Like I'm a God-fearing Christian. I'm God-fearing of my God and my Lord and Savior, and that helps keep you in the straight and narrow. But when you don't have a fear of anything, and you're going to treat everything with a pragmatic, practical solution, I think the humanity is lost.
That's an interesting take on it. Elon Musk's Neuralink. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
I've read some of it, not all of it.
So Neuralink is his idea to put AI and humans together. You implant a chip into your head, and you'll be able to download skills and upload memories, and then it's a database of all that. Would you be somebody that would try that? Being now that you're in the digital landscape world, would you entertain that idea?
Yes.
What do you think would? How do you think it would benefit you?
Well, how it would benefit me, it would have benefit to people come after me.
Interesting.
If you don't leave a living legacy, it all gets lost. Let me tell you something. I'm most proud of the things I didn't say when I was in government, because I had a lot of chance to say some stuff that was correct but was hurtful. And I'm also most proud of the experiences I've had that I may not get to share. And the experiences, Josh, that are most valuable to people are not my successes, are my failures. What didn't work? I tell people, I'm not going to tell you what worked, I'm going to tell you what didn't work.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to use that, great, and you don't want to use it, that's fine. But what you talked about, the Neuralink with Elon Musk, where you mesh, you know, the human psyche with artificial intelligence, if we do it right, maybe that's the way that becomes an encyclopedia. And I know you're too young to use encyclopedias.
I've heard of them.
I used them.
Yeah.
But they were the resource. And you'd go into them if you did a book report, if you wanted information. So how are future generations going to use us as a resource so they don't make the same mistakes we made? Because
right. One
thing's for sure, you know, history does repeat itself, but it doesn't have to, especially if it's bad history, if it's the Holocaust, or if it's, you know, the Hitler experience, where we learned that humanity can be cruel and vicious, and we shouldn't forget those not so happy moments, because our humanity might depend on it. So if you offer somebody like myself the chance to be a resource to future generations, where they can go back to, well, you know what, I'm a mayor of a small town, let me see what this mayor did back then to try to help his community. Because, you know what, we're also poor, and we're also disadvantaged, and we're also struggling to try to grapple what government is.
Right.
Well, what about a few clicks and a button, and you talk to a mayor that lived in the year, from the year 1963 to the year, you know, 2045.
Yeah.
And all the experiences he had. Experience, you know what, it's an amazing, amazing tool if you have it available. But if you don't, you know, my father gave me a lot of his wisdom, whether I liked it or not, when I was growing up. And as I proceed in life, and as I proceeded in government, I keep on going back to government, because I'll tell you what, Josh, I did it with integrity and honesty and a lot of pride in community, and I never took anything that wasn't mine. But that goes to the values that my father taught me. Now, going back to what we were talking about before, you know, again, if we can become a resource, an encyclopedia, a living encyclopedia, where somebody can go and click a few buttons and find the deep experiences that you had, and they get to be able to help their community in a positive way, to give them clean water, to give them better public security, to give them a fire department, to go in and create a park system, to go in and even have a solid waste program. I'm telling you, the experience that I had. When I came in Rio Grande City, we didn't even have a system to go pick up your trash.
Really?
See, you're surprised. It wasn't, yeah. You know, that's where we came on. It was a controversy. Are we going to allow our community to have somebody come in and pick up your trash? It was a controversy. Wow. One of those controversies, they said they're going to run me out on the rail because I went and hired a company that came, picked up the trash in an orderly manner, and that I had unemployed. You know, those are like four or five viejitos around town that pick up the trash in the truck and stuff like that, and it became a controversy. So I go far enough back, 2001 when I came on, where there was no solid waste collection.
Interesting. I guess now we just take that for granted.
Like, oh, yeah.
You're going to pick it up.
No, you see, you take it for granted.
Yeah.
I did not, and I never will. Hats off to Mission, Texas, where I live, because they pick up my trash twice a week. How amazing is that? You see, I was used to Edinburgh. Edinburgh was once a week. Mission is twice a week. That's amazing. I'm thrilled, and I give them a tip of the hat. But again, going back to what we're talking about, let's be a resource, and if there's a way to bridge that gap to become a resource, you know, to give people insights into business or government or to podcasting,
yeah,
or to social media, what better?
Yeah.
That shows the advancement of our humanity.
No, I completely agree with you. So before we leave here, in all your cumulative years of experience, what is the best piece of advice that you can give somebody or anybody?
Don't be timid.
It doesn't matter what industry.
It's easy. Don't be timid. Don't be timid. Don't sit in the back of the room. Sit in the front of the room. If you think you can roll with the big dogs, go give it a try. You know, the fact that we're Hispanic or brown-skinned, or that we, you know, may not speak English as good as the next person, or Spanish for that matter, don't be timid. You know, we come from a community that's rich in culture, and if anybody thinks that we're not prepared to hit the great big world, we are. And it goes back to confidence. Be confident and be assertive in your presence in this world. Because I assure you that anybody else who's, whether you're in television or radio or social media, whatever you want, the next person might be doing it better because they're not timid, they're confident, and they're consistent.
Yeah.
So I tell people all the time, don't be timid. You know, be brash, be bold, be gutsy, and get after it.
Before we leave, I'll make sure people can find you in all of your channels. So can you share that with us?
That's super easy. I am Border Mayor across all my social medias, BoderMayor. And that includes Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. They will find me. I handle all my own social media accounts, and I will answer any direct message that's sent to me.
Awesome. Ruben, I appreciate you coming on the podcast, and I appreciate everything that you taught me, the insights, and I look forward to seeing everything that you do in the future.
Josh, a million thank you. Best of luck, and you keep on going after it, and don't be timid.
I'll talk to you soon, bro.
God bless.
Welcome to the Joshua Morales Podcast.